Thank you, Cynthia, for asking me to be here to talk about what's happening locally in Massachusetts and the statewide legislation. So I don't quite have the same level of passion as Fred, and I don't have this touching story that CVS has, and I certainly don't have a cute Mexican partner. But what I do have is name-dropping. So I'm going to name-drop for a second. I had the honor of meeting with Assistant Secretary of Health Howard Koh last year when he was the Assistant Secretary. And what he had on his desk was a little placard that said something to the effect of, sometimes it's fun to do the impossible. And I like to think about this because last year, probably most of us would say, it's impossible to think about CVS pulling tobacco products from their shelves. It's impossible to go smoke-free in bars, smoke-free NOLA. It's impossible. How can we ever get there? And I think that these stories that we're hearing today, that is that it is possible. We just got to kind of keep the cog moving and keep the wheels moving. I think the other thing that's sort of related to the impossibility is that when CVS made their announcement and you actually went forward a month early, the local tobacco control programs in our state were so excited because what it meant for them was they could take CVS out of their list of places that they needed to go check and do enforcement. So they were like, oh my God, this is like feedback you just made my day that I can take these out of my system. So it's like this little thing that really made a big difference for them. And that's one of the things that we talk about with going tobacco-free in all the pharmacies is the benefit that it has for enforcement and the use of efficient use of dollars to do that enforcement because you have fewer places that you're going to check for compliance and doing inspections. So why do we even care about tobacco in pharmacies? And I think you've already heard it, you already know it, sort of this incongruity with health and selling products that are dangerous. And Cheryl is here, and she loves to talk about how defective cigarettes are, that they are the most defective product that we have on the planet. And they're also the most littered product. And so when we think about tobacco in pharmacies, it's sort of the same umbrella concept of the defectiveness. Like, why are we allowing and supporting the sale of products that, when used as intended, harm your health and lead to death and disease? And, you know, the latest Surgeon General's report, I don't know if you had the pleasure of reading that nice 1,000-page report, I did, and in there it talks about how tobacco affects every single organ in our bodies. Every single organ is touched and affected by smoking. So this was actually taken during the summer in one of our local pharmacies out in Western Mass, and what it is sort of advertising is that if you use your wellness card for any products in this pharmacy, you actually get a discount on your tobacco products. So here's a picture of it close up. So you get it 10 cents off, not a huge amount, but still. I mean, what are they really trying to say here? What are they really trying to sell? And so it's just sort of this really, you know, unconscionable action that's taking place. Yeah, we're in the business of health and selling, you know, medicines, and back to the ad that you had on the bus, you know, it's like, here, go to this aisle to help your cough, go to this aisle for a persistent cough. This is sort of the same kind of idea. Buy your product and you'll get a discount using your wellness card. So let me tell you a little bit of the story in the background of what happened in Massachusetts locally and kind of how we're having this, you know, wildfire, if you will, of municipalities passing local ordinances to ban the sale of tobacco in pharmacies. So back in about 2002, there was this group, and it still is in existence in Dorchester, Teens Against Tobacco. And they had an advisor, Reverend Bill Lesh, who actually had marched with Dr. Martin Luther King and brought to the young people some of the sort of approaches to fighting social justice and fighting for the rights of African Americans in our country. And the main things that he focused on in training the young people was to know what the law is, to know what your rights are, to know how to talk to the press. And he even talked about, with the kids, doing the impossible. Like, don't think that it's really impossible, just kind of keep moving forward. And so those are the things that he has talked about with the youth in Dorchester. And they would picket in front of pharmacies as well as drugstores and supermarkets. They protested in front of CVS, as a matter of fact. And these young people, you know, were trained well enough that if they were approached by a business owner who came out and, you know, gave them a hard time about, well, you can't be here, they knew exactly what their rights were. They knew exactly what they needed to do, and they understood what their parameters were. So they did this over and over and over and over again in front of all of these different stores And eventually, what they have been working towards is trying to get a local regulation passed. And there was a change in leadership. And that's what actually got Boston to go first, was the Barbara Ferreira, the past Boston Public Health Commissioner, came in and said, hey, let's just get this done. And boom, it was passed. And what's happened now is that the ordinance is, or the regulation, is a model policy. The state of Massachusetts is actually, for those of you who aren't familiar, we don't have strong county system. We actually have very strong home rule. So all of our 351 cities and towns have their own boards of health, and they have the authority to pass regulations at the local level. So they don't have to go through city council, they don't have to go through town meeting or anything like that. They're able to pass local regs. So this is why we're able to get a lot of different policies passed in our state, is just because of the way that we're structured. And so the model, the State Department of Public Health provides a lot of support to the locals to go and do a lot of these policy changes. And the pharmacy ban is what we call it. It's restriction on sale of tobacco products in healthcare institutions is officially what it's called. And so that is part of the model regs that all of our localities are working on. And Cheryl Sabara is one of the public health law attorneys that works with the localities to, you know, write up the regulations and to help get them passed in the locality. And for whatever reason, the wrong presentation is uploaded. But right now what we have are 102 municipalities that have the ban passed. And taking these in conjunction with CVS not selling, what that means is we have about 60% of our population, if it lives in a community where a pharmacy is not selling tobacco products. So it's either because of CVS or there's a local ordinance that has banned the sale. So sort of to bring this up to the part that I'm here to talk about, in addition to the local work, is the statewide effort. So we've actually had a bill that's been filed 3 sessions now. Massachusetts has a full-time legislature. They're in a session, basically a formal session for 18 months. So we're heading into our next formal session as of in January. And the bill has been filed 3 times. With Rep. Garvely, and this year we were asking for them to add e-cigarettes because in the past the language did not include e-cigarettes. So we're anticipating, did not pass, it passed through our public health committee, it made it to healthcare finance committee, but it keeps getting stalled. And many of you are probably saying, it's a no-brainer. Like, even little kids know it's a no-brainer that you shouldn't be selling tobacco products where in a pharmacy. But we cannot quite seem to yet get our legislature to sort of understand this and to sort of see this the way that we're seeing it, as a way to protect public health. But I want to talk a little bit about the efforts that we've been engaged in and what our hope is for this next legislative session. So I'm the director of Tobacco Free Mass. I'm the lobbyist for Tobacco Free Mass, working on policy. We have 80 members of our coalition, and so we worked with the primary sponsor of the bill, Rep. Garvely. We actually had CVS come up and do a legislative briefing for us. Troy Brennan, Dr. Brennan, came up and did that for us to talk to legislators about the importance of the decision that CVS made and the importance of removing tobacco products from pharmacies. Every chance we get, we're updating this list. So you'll see on this list, I think it says there are 83 municipalities. So we've added another 20 or so. And this was back in, this would have been April of this year. So we're continuing, just like San Francisco and California, we're continuing to add more communities. And what our focus really has been is, you know, the incongruity of selling tobacco products when you're selling medication, you know, there are so many already that have gone in this direction. It's just sort of like now we feel like we're at the tipping point. And so our efforts for this upcoming year will be continue to talk to legislators, have a conversation. I think, Fred, your point about engaging pharmacies and engaging the pharmacy schools is very well taken. I think we can probably do a slightly better job of really engaging in that way. But I also find it very interesting that since 1971, the American Pharmacists Association has had a position on not selling tobacco products in pharmacies. Now, I'm 40, so it's been like longer than my lifetime, longer than me being on this earth, that this position has been out there, and we still have this in action. And like you said, Bob, you know, it's like all of these other countries, you know, the UK, Ireland, they don't sell tobacco products in their pharmacies, yet we do. And so we have a ways to go. So I guess my question back to you, and I think the whole purpose of this session and the purpose of CVS's decision is, is this what we want our pharmacies to look like? Is this what we want to see when we walk into a pharmacy? And if you ask a lot of...
No.
Right, thank you. You want to say that again?
No.
So when we, when I talk to smokers or ex-smokers, what I hear from them and what I hear from a lot of people who laud CVS's efforts and their decision is that it makes it easier for them as an ex-smoker to know that they can go into CVS if they're having a bad day and go get a pack of gum or go get a candy bar or go, you know, buy some makeup or whatever it is. They can go into the store and know that they're not going to be triggered by seeing cigarettes as they check out. And that was just maybe about 3 weeks ago that somebody said that to me. And we hear the same thing about smoke-free workplaces, that, you know, people can go to these places and not be triggered. And I think that's part of the whole focus with public health, is that we're trying to help people not only try to make a quit attempt, because it takes about 7 to 11 times for someone to actually quit smoking, but once they are quit, to continue to help them stay quit. And I think that that kind of goes back to the whole effort with the cessation program that CVS has also rolled out. So my question again is, do we want to see this, or do we want to see something more like this? That's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to all the speakers, and actually, if the speakers wouldn't mind coming up here as we move into the Q&A section, then we'll hopefully we'll see if we can move this mic around or they can jump up. Just to give an overview, you know, there are over 100, and I think it's probably 25 or 30 localities that have these, you know, tobacco-free pharmacies laws on the books. No states yet. Where we're seeing these laws mostly at this time are in those states that have smoke-free, you know, statewide smoke-free laws. And so whether, again, as we look at this, as we move along the policy continuum, is a question for the group. Sometimes places that maybe have preemption of working on, say, smoke-free workplace laws, if you're not preempted from working in other areas, maybe working on tobacco-free pharmacies would be a good approach. But what we've heard today is that these laws are, A, legal. You have the authority to work on them, assuming you're not preempted in your state. They are effective. We saw that from the CVS preliminary research that in San Francisco and Boston that smoking prevalence is going down. And then we heard from Tammy's presentation, but also it's hopefully going to prevent not only triggering a former smoker from wanting to grab another pack, but preventing a new generation of smokers. So with that enormous benefit from the CVS decision, and we are, but what's the benefit of saying having voluntary policies versus working on these laws that would then cover all of the outlets in those communities? And the first question goes to the gentleman here. And if you could stand up and announce yourself. And
yes. I'm Dave Pendeth of Olympia, Washington. I think this is a wonderful idea. I think that regardless of impact on consumption, it will help us in the long run to denormalize the sale of tobacco as in any way connected with positive health. I think these are great things, but we all set priorities. And in light of that, I was dismayed by Dr. Schrenk's slide, which showed a downward graph with a lot of sawtoothing and point-to-point variability, in which at the point of smoke-free, tobacco-free pharmacies, I saw neither an obvious inflection point in the slope nor an obvious step-off in the absolute numbers. And I'm thinking, as a short-term strategy, this may have a small payoff for public health rather than a long-run payoff, rather than a large one. And I'm hoping it has a long-run payoff, which I do expect. But can you go a little deeper into those data, and do they in fact show a substantial short-term payoff for public health, or do they not show a substantial short-term payoff, so we need to look at other stuff too?
Yeah. So you're right, I glossed over that quickly, and I did not take the necessary time to sort of describe the evaluation. So what we did is we conducted an interrupted time series analysis. So we considered both the level and slope before and after both interventions, using data from IRI. So the data that we got was it's really an extraordinary data set where IRI pays consumers to have a scanner at home, and they scan every single thing they purchase. So they have this extraordinary sort of data source of everything that these folks buy. So we looked at the level and slope before, the level and slope after, just before, and if you did not account for the slope before and after, the difference was 13.3% reduction, but that was largely driven by a downward trend overall. If you do account for the underlying slope changes, it was 5.5%. We did a couple sensitivity analyses that were interesting. We used negative controls, so we put in, we included things that would not have been sensitive to the ban: the sale of coffee, the sale of soda, and the sale of, I think it was chewing gum, and saw no significant difference in sales of any of those that aligned with the dates of the ban. And we also used external controls. So we looked at rates of smoking, or proportion of people smoking in Baltimore and Seattle before and after, and did not see trends that reflected those trends that in San Francisco and Boston. Is it a perfect analysis? No, it's not a randomized trial. It's, you know, there. Anyone can always find fault with an epidemiologic study, but you know, an interrupted time series with concurrent controls is widely considered to be about as valid an epidemiologic study as you can do. And the fact that we use both internal and external controls, I think, helps to validate those results. To some extent, whether it's 4% or 6% or 7% isn't the issue here. The issue is that it makes a difference. You know, there did appear to be a meaningful change. And if retail pharmacies have the ability to make a decision that makes a meaningful change at a neighborhood, at a population level, in the amount of people smoking, that's something that I think we all agree is valuable.
I would define 5.5% or anything in that range as a huge impact, as a huge short-term impact, and I like that a lot. Your slide did not make it obvious, and the step-off just looked like you were cooking the numbers.
So I apologize for the lack of clarity.
Nice job. Thank you.
Cheryl, and then we'll come back to you, Fred.
Hi. I would also just add to that it also affects the density of just how many tobacco outlets there actually are. Yeah. I'm Cheryl Scar from Massachusetts. I also want to point out, because this happened when we started working on not selling tobacco in healthcare institutions, including pharmacies, we initially got some opposition from lawyers from NATO, the National Association of Tobacco Outlets, and some other entities. And they claimed that you boards of health, you better be careful, because there was a lawsuit in San Francisco, and San Francisco lost that lawsuit. So that's all they said. So just be careful. So we, of course, said, holy crap. And we went and read the lawsuit, and the reason San Francisco lost that lawsuit is because a big box store, and correct me if I'm getting this incorrect, but a big box store sued because there was an exemption in the San Francisco law initially that exempted out big box stores. And what the court said was, if you have a rational basis for banning this in pharmacies, why are you separating out these big box pharmacies from the other pharmacies? And so San Francisco went back in and amended their regulations so that it covered all pharmacies. But that didn't stop NATO from continuing to send that letter to all of our boards of health. And they did it for years, and they just stopped because it frightened. It bullied local government from actually trying to do something because they didn't tell the truth. So if that does happen, know that lawsuit did not result in San Francisco not going forward with their pharmacy ban.
Thanks, Cheryl. Any more on that, Bob? Okay, Fred, this may stretch. Don't pull it any harder, though. You may have to stand up, but it's about all the give we got.
All the give we got. Just from the gentleman from Washington, a quick comment. I have a kid by the name of Charlie Mayer, and he's past president of the American College of Family Physicians up there in King County. He's in Seattle, and he works for an outfit called Kaiser Group Health. And Charlie, being past president, they're putting mini clinics all over the country in pharmacies, like CVS mentioned, and also Walgreens. And Charlie Mayer went to Group Health because they're putting in three mini clinics in the Barrett Bartlett Pharmacy. It's a small chain of about 18 or 20.
Bartell.
Anybody from Washington State? Anyway, Bartell. So if you folks in the back in Washington, if you're from Washington, if you could support him, he went to management and said, look, CVS just quit. They threw out all cigarettes in all their mini clinics and all their pharmacies. Would you do this also in Washington? And he's working now with Group Health. So if you folks in Tobacco would get together with Charlie Mayer, Group Health, and I'll send you my email afterwards, we'd love to have you. This is like one person does make a difference. So CVS started the thing. And if you could pick up on this, and each one of you people in the states where the mini clinics are can do the same thing with the Walgreens, it would be magnificent. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Dr. Schrank. I'm wondering, you know, what was some of the discussion that went on before the decision was made that we can learn from as we go working with other chains or just even working at the local and state level to try to get these laws passed? I mean, what were some of the arguments or the key factors, well, arguments against and then the key factors that helped tip the scale into the yes, you know, or the no tobacco sales column?
Well, the one thing that I think was overwhelmingly true, that was just sort of palpable, is the fact that there are no pharmacists that want to be selling cigarettes. If you listen to the people that work for your company, if you listen to the people delivering care on the front line, if you listen to the people who are actually serving your customers, that is, I mean, there's no two ways about it. I was relatively new at the company. It's not as though I can speak to how all the conversations happened, but that was one thing that was sort of overwhelmingly salient and unquestionably a tipping point. The other thing is we have a progressive board with, you know, folks that see a world that's different today, one where our healthcare system actually takes better care of people, and they think that in that setting we might be able to do some good.
And sort of my next question is, did you have any pushback from, say, shareholders or board members looking at it from more the financial economic side?
So I wasn't close enough to this to really speak to that.
That's fine. So I'm wondering, Tammy, would that maybe help? I'm wondering, what is it about at the legislature that they're not supportive of this? What are their arguments about not wanting to pass a state law when so many of the boroughs and towns in Massachusetts are doing it?
Well, quite honestly, it's politics. You know, the folks who are the sponsors, the way it works in Massachusetts, it's all about the leadership. And if leadership wants something to happen, it will happen. And so I think part of it for us is making the case stronger with leadership to get it kind of moving. It made it out of Public Health Committee, which is great. It went to Healthcare Finance. We heard numerous times that it would get bounced out of Healthcare Finance. Even the sponsor was told that it was going to move this past session, and then it didn't. It just died at the end of our formal session. So we have a little bit more work to do. And, you know, we really did try to capitalize on the work that CVS did, the decision to try to make the case. And just, you know, it's about the leadership and competing priorities up at the State House.
Just to follow on that, I think another thing is, if we were to try what Massachusetts has been doing at the state level, we're going to face the same problem, and that is that about 50% of our elected officials in the California State Assembly and the State Senate and Governor Jerry Brown, who took $100,000 from the tobacco industry, is a lot of what we're facing to get anything done at the state level. And that's where the tobacco industry does their best game, is at the state and federal level. Where we do our public health work is at the local level where there are local policies.
Absolutely. Other questions? Yes. Dr. Mercer.
If you're presenting this to a pharmacy, how do you answer the question about what do you want next? Alcohol, soda, unhealthy food?
It's a great question. When we went before the California Board of Pharmacy, we've been 20 times before them approximately. To make a long story short, they said to us, again, these are pharmacists, if you go after tobacco now, are you going to come back for alcohol? Because everybody knows CVS sells alcohol. And the answer is right now, for me, I'm after cigarettes and e-cigarettes right now. That's all I wanted. But the question did come up, well, then are you going to go after candy? And then are you going to go after, and to be honest, if you're a public health person, are you going to go after diet sodas? And the city of Berkeley just passed about a excess tax. And I guess the answer is yes, for me. But I'm 81 years of age, and I can say this kind of thing. But again, CVS, if I were to put them on the spot and say, you're going to get rid of tobacco, I mean alcohol, or at least, you know, do more than you could do or an education program, and again, you know, it's perfectly legal. When we went to Walgreens, the head of Walgreens is a fellow by the name of Greg Wasson, and he's a Purdue graduate. Anybody from Purdue out there? Anybody from Indiana out there? He's a Purdue.
You're right there.
The one in the back. He's a pharmacist. We wrote to him. We've been writing to him like we have the head of CVS. Make a long story short, Merlo's name is. Before Merlo, there was a fellow by the name of Ryan. We've become great friends. He's got a number on my head, but that's another story. When we went after Greg Wasson, he wrote us a letter. He's a pharmacist. He graduated from Purdue. So anybody from Indiana, put some heat on them, because pharmacists do not want to sell cigarettes. And the response he came back is, one, it's legal, Fred. Two, it's an economic incentive to put it in. And we, three, represents, he called it again, a fiduciary responsibility to the stockholders to sell and make money. So if we could convince Walgreens that we can make more money by the stock going up, by doing the right thing, by selling something else in this place, and I'm not sure, maybe our panelists could to talk about how he's going to overcome $2 billion that he's given up in tobacco. But Wesson needs to be convinced from Walgreens, and that's why we need to do something to convince Walgreens. But I'm not sure. But the fiduciary responsibility is a legitimate thing. He is in that job to make money for the corporation. And again, I'm a pharmacist, public health person. I don't know how this works.
There were other hands I saw. Sir, I guess Derek and then Joyce. Disconcerting.
CVS isn't going to sell any cigarettes.
A couple things in response to that. You know, I think pharmacists and doctors are really not supposed to be prescribing or offering products that are not FDA approved. So I think that's in part the argument for not including or for including e-cigarettes in any of the local bans that we have going on in Massachusetts. And what we've had to do is kind of go back to some of the municipalities and add in the e-cigarette piece. And like I said, we'll be adding that into the legislation that we have filed in January. But, you know, the science is not there, the evidence is not there. And one of the things kind of in response back to the earlier question, too, is, you know, it's a bad business plan to be selling a product that's going to kill your users, right? And so I think the question is, back to what you said, Fred, make the case for how you can continue to make money and change your business plan, change the focus of the way that you're doing business to not sell these products. And so it's really important to include e-cigarettes from a public health perspective, because when we look at who's using these products, who's really increasing their use, we had a tripling of use in 1 year among young people. That's really concerning when you know how addictive nicotine is, regardless of what it might or might not do to your body, your cardiovascular system, your brain, your heart, the whole, you know, your lungs, the whole thing. But nicotine is like the most addictive substance. So why would we want to allow the sale and the use of such a product and have such an impact on our young people? And we know that it changes kids' brains and primes their brains for addiction to other substances and in the brain. So, you know, just from even that perspective, when you think about addiction, you think about the connections with this, you know, opioid overdoses and opioid use and alcoholism and marijuana use, they're all interconnected. And we need to take a stand against e-cigarettes and say, you know what, it might be a different might be a safer product for some people, but that's a decision between a doctor and a smoker. It's not for public health to get involved. We need to be looking at the system as a whole.
So, well, Joyce had one, and no?
Six in the entire state, independent, small, not chains, that sell cigarettes. Only six, and we're working on the six.
Right.
But I don't think you have much of a problem. The independents, most of them do not sell. It's the chains that sell, other than CVS, Target, and the third big one I can't remember.
Wegmans. So one. Right. Go ahead. Stand up. Yep. Yep.
Family medicine, I know your son. But I have a slightly tangential question about what's happened in Winchester, Massachusetts.
Westminster.
So they can't sell it anywhere, whether they're a pharmacy or not. And I would love to hear a little bit more about that. And
well, it was a proposed ban. They had a hearing on November 12th that they shut down after 30 minutes because the crowd was really unruly. And they will be making their decision in December. They're accepting written comments, right?
No. I was there. I had the pleasure of being there in this conference call yesterday. This was a proposal that came from the Board of Health in Westminster. It wasn't, it was their decision. They did hold a hearing. The hearing was completely out of control. The Board of Health chair closed it. And just yesterday, what they decided to do is to withdraw the proposal at this time because they don't have community support or any visible community support, and a regulation is really only as good as your ability to enforce it. So without community support, it would be really difficult to move forward on that. So the health director has spoken with each member of the Board of Health individually, and two of them really want to do that. So they will hold a hearing, a meeting Monday, and that is what will most likely happen.
Great.
My second
question. Oh, okay, quickly.
It was about San Francisco and when they banned all tobacco sales in all pharmacies. Was there a deal about Costco in San Francisco?
Yes.
And so they also banned. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Great.
Any pharmacy that's licensed by the state board of pharmacy. So that's any pharmacy.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very, very much for coming to this session. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists with a round of applause. Thank you. It was a pleasure.